and welcome to this first edition of the Monocle Weekly. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's Sunday, December 28th, 2008. Ahead on today's programme, author and philosopher Alain de Botton is here to talk about why happiness is not just a personal issue, but a political one.
There is no wealth but life, so concentrate on your portfolio of life and not on your portfolio of cash.
That was Alain de Botton, who'll also be telling us a bit about his forthcoming book. And after that, our very own culture editor, Robert Bound, will be here with a few music and filmic tips to keep you going through the holidays, including this.
I'm standing on the edge. I'm looking over, swaying from side to side.
We'll be hearing a bit more from the Phantom Band in a moment, and we'll also be crossing to Oslo shortly to speak to Martin Schenke of the Norwegian Finance Ministry about the finer points of managing state wealth. But before that, I'm joined here in London by a few of my Monocle colleagues, including our editor Andrew Tuck, Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson, and our culture editor Robert Bound. In a moment, I'm going to ask you all about the stories you're keeping an eye on over the year ahead. But first, Rob, good Christmas.
A very good Christmas, thanks, Tyler. Very good.
What did you do?
I was down in Sussex with my parents, and I'll be whizzing off to Verbier for some skiing for New Year.
Great, can't wait to hear about it. Fiona?
Well, I was in London, which was a novelty for me. I've spent the last few Christmases away in Japan and various places in Asia, so it's good to be home.
Cozy?
Very cozy. That's very important.
Andrew?
I followed Rob's example. I was down in the countryside for Christmas, and tomorrow I go to Cape Town.
Very good. Rob, I want to start with you. Looking ahead, and obviously we've recently wrapped, well, two issues because February's coming out soon, but if we look at sort of the broader cultural and media landscape, what are you keeping an eye on for the next, well, 6 to 12 months anyway?
Well, I'll be wanting to look at, ventures such as our own, interesting, great new sort of startup radio stations. I also want to be having a look at, strangely, the return of craft in music and the way that people are remaking not just vinyls but CDs. Deluxe packaging seems to be coming back, which is a kind of interesting thing, and a sort of it's anti the trend of MP3s.
So you're not just talking about crafting your own MySpace page?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, we saw last year Amy Winehouse re-release Back to Back in a deluxe version, and it seemed one of those things that's entirely unnecessary, and it was number one for weeks. I think people kind of want still collector's items of things and want to have something to hold in their hands.
Fiona, if you look at our forecast issue, what were the things that were really standing out for you when you're talking to our correspondents in Asia, and what are you keeping an eye on?
Well, I think one of the things in Japan is the issue of the ageing society, which is just going to get more and more pronounced. And that's definitely an issue that will affect the rest of the world soon. So it'll be interesting to see how they lead the way.
Are all sectors focusing on it, from hotel groups, I would imagine, property development companies, retailers? Is everyone looking at this right now in Japan?
Absolutely. Anyone with any sense. So we're seeing magazines for older people, cosmetics for older people, travel tours aimed at older people.
I rather liked Oily Boy,
yes.
a new title for... I'm not sure who Oily Boys are, but it was interesting because there's been this obviously boom of women's magazines for women who really are acting their age, and it's interesting that the same thing's being reflected for men right now.
Definitely. I think there's this whole sector of men just being discovered by retailers and magazine publishers who have money to spend. They still want to be fashionable. So,
Andrew?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things I'm interested in seeing what happens is just how people innovate over the coming year. People are talking about kind of opportunity on everything from our high street to kind of politics. And I'm just really keen to see how people kind of, you know, progress through this following year, which, you know, lots of people think are going to be tough. But I think there's going to be lots of people who start up over the next year who are going to actually have really strong, interesting businesses.
Great. Well, we'll be coming back to all of you in a moment. But first, who can you trust with your money these days? In the next issue of Monocle, we have some rather alarming tales from Iceland that we'll be sharing with you next week. But today, we wanted to talk to a gentleman who oversees the assets of one of the world's wealthiest and most admired nations, Norway. Martin Schenke is the Director General of the Norwegian Ministry of Finance and is also head of the Asset Management Department, and he joins me on the line now from Oslo. Mr. Schenke, I wanted to start by asking you, I guess the obvious question, what has Norway been doing right, and why are all eyes on you, or at least most eyes anyway?
Well, I think it's a bit of good luck and a bit of maybe cautious economic planning, and I think you need a little bit of both, perhaps. So the bit of luck is, of course, finding and exploiting the petroleum resources. But many nations have found that natural resource income is more a curse than a blessing. So I think it is important also to manage these in a wise, prudent way with a long-term view. And one of the things that we've put emphasis on is to save a large part of this money in a fund for two purposes. One is the short-term purpose of stabilizing the economy, insulating the economy from shifts in international demand and oil prices. And the other more long-term objective is saving a part of our revenues for future generations. And I think that is something that we can benefit from now, because we have a fund which gives us a large amount of flexibility in our fiscal policy. And that makes it easier for us to handle this economic downturn that we're going into now.
I noticed on your CV that you're ex-McKinsey, and I'm wondering if you're playing a bit of a consultant role as well with other finance ministers beating a path to your door. Is there a lot of people lined up to see what you've been doing right?
We've certainly had a lot of contact with other countries with similar funds, talking to them on aspects of fund management. I have to say that we share what knowledge we have, but we have also learned a lot from many other countries who are very advanced in their thinking on fund management issues. Countries like Singapore, Australia, and other countries where we've worked a lot of the U.S. funds, where we have learned a lot. But also we have tried to share some of our experiences in handling the macroeconomic aspects of oil revenues with oil-producing countries, in various parts of the world.
If you look west out across the Atlantic and we look over to Reykjavik, your view, obviously very close relationship with Iceland, but what really went wrong there from your perspective?
Well, I think the vulnerability of the economy was very large. And I think that is the key word here, that how do you manage your economy to be less vulnerable to external shocks? And obviously, the banking sector became very dominant with total assets of maybe 10 or 12 times GDP. I think that is something that perhaps many other countries will try to learn from, because it says something about the vulnerability of the financial sector more in general in an age where financial institutions have become much more globalized than governments have. But that clearly was one of the main aspects of the Icelandic situation, that these banks had become very large, and too large to be sufficiently supported by the host government where they were located.
Well, New Year's Eve is almost upon us. So if you look into your crystal ball or ice ball, whatever you have up in Oslo, what are the red alerts and also, I think, the opportunities on the horizon? What do you see?
Well, I think we will still see a lot of the aftershocks of the financial crisis. It will not be sorted out during 2009. And I think in 2009, governments and regulators have to think very hard about how to set new regulations, appropriate regulations for financial institutions. And then, of course, handling of the real economic after effects of the financial crisis, which I think will be the big issue for 2009. How do we deal with those effects? And what we're seeing is, I think, unprecedented coordinated action globally, on a global scale, which we really haven't seen before on this scale. I think that gives us a lot of hope that we will be able to deal with this crisis and avoid the worst sort of depression-like scenarios that some people have been playing with.
Great. Martin Skake in Oslo, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from London. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly, where we're also joined by our regular contributor and FT Markets correspondent, Rachel Moraghi. Well, Rachel, what did you make of all of that?
It was good to see that he didn't think that we were sliding into the big depression. It's nice to see that there's a bit of a ray of light at the end of the tunnel coming up.
Well, you can say that when you're in Oslo.
I think for the rest of us, this is going to be a very tough year. But that doesn't mean that there are no opportunities out there.
So what's in your bag of tricks today then?
I mean, I think one of the big lessons from this last year is that if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. The rather fabulously named Bernard Madoff, who made off with lots of people's money in a pyramid scheme, or at least allegedly. I think that there isn't going to be a kind of quick fix, quick return buck, and people are going to have to start looking for long-term sustainable value in projects. So I think perhaps the aging population, renewable energy. One of the things that Warren Buffett always says is that when people are greedy, you should be fearful, and when people are fearful, you should be greedy. And he's been wandering around the States buying up stocks. I think it's very difficult to predict when the markets will hit a bottom. But I think, you know, if you're buying things and you're looking at long-term value, sustainable returns over a long period, that's the kind of way people need to be thinking now, and not how to get a quick buck, unless you're prepared to basically treat the markets like a roulette table.
Well, if we go to the other side, there were stories that run up to Christmas just about the amount of money that's well, waiting to be unlocked in biscuit tins in the UK. I know Fiona, in Japan, I guess it's called belly button money, just the amount of money under the tatami or under futons. Do you think that there are people out there who are thinking, well, how do we actually unlock this cash?
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of cash sitting idle, just waiting for the right opportunities. There was a very funny story in the FT just about how the amount of money stashed under people's mattresses and in biscuit tins had almost doubled in the UK as people couldn't really decide what to do with it and were so leaving it at home. I think the average amount of cash in UK households had gone up to about £700, and we could have bailed out a couple of the banks just from our biscuit tins.
Fiona, I think in Japan, doesn't it run to the average of something like 5 figures in US dollars? I mean, it's some extraordinary number.
Yes, and I think at the moment people are so nervous, everyone's holding tight onto their cash, so people don't really want to put it into banks at the moment.
Rachel, but if you were around a roulette table, are there any things that that you are looking at, and either things that you've got in the pipeline to report on for us, or things that you feel you've talked about, obviously, you know, anything sustainable, looking at obviously the energy sector, but any surprises as well?
Well, I think the big theme for the next year and going forward as well is going to be a real shifting in the economic tectonic plates, if you like. We're going to see a real shift in wealth from west to east. And obviously, emerging markets have taken a pounding this year. But I think a lot of that had to do with people betting that they were going to pull us out of the hole that we were in. I think anybody who knows how Indians and Chinese ordinary people save knew that that wasn't going to be true. But that doesn't mean that the long-term trends of China, India, Brazil, certainly heading towards longer, more sustainable growth, getting richer, getting wealthier, that still holds true. So it's about finding the right opportunities in those places.
Great. Rachel Maraji, thank you very much. Well, up next, we're joined by author and philosopher Alain de Botton. This is The Monocle Weekly. You're back with Monocle Weekly now. Our next guest has a massive female fan base in South Korea and a cult following in Australia for his book Status Anxiety and The Art of Travel, and also for his contributions in Monocle, including his essay in our current issue on happiness. Alain de Botton, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I could see you smiling through the glass, actually, when we had Mr. Skenke on from Oslo. What did you make of him as a minister?
Well, he was extremely reassuring. You realise that there really is a divide between the kind of Anglo-American look at it for today, short-term view, and the more Nordic, Swiss, Germanic sector, which takes such a reassuringly solid perspective on events. So it's heartening to know that he's out there.
Now, for people listening who have not picked up our December-January issue, just can you encapsulate what your essay on happiness is all about?
Well, my argument is that for a long time, at least a decade, people have been pinning their hopes for fulfillment and happiness on a rising stock market, rising wealth. 2009 is going to be a year when everyone will probably finish the year poorer than they began it. It's a very, very unusual situation. So people are going to need to do something with their ambition. Human beings are inherently ambitious creatures. We want to get better at things. And mostly what we've been getting better at is making money. And we're not going to be able to do that. So it's really a problem of ambition. What are we going to do with our desire to get better? And I'm really arguing that we're going to have to look for fulfillment elsewhere in things that are not captured by the strict economic parameters that we've tended to look at.
So what does it look and sound like then?
Well, it's many familiar things. They're familiar partly because we're used to mentioning them without doing anything about them. Personal relationships, the fulfillment in a job that's available from doing the job itself rather than immediate economic return. In my piece, I discussed the thought of the English 19th century critic John Ruskin, who came up with the definition of wealth. He said, you know, the normal idea of wealth is not right. He said, there is no wealth but life, and then defined life as all the sorts of things that we imagine when we're on our deathbed, all the things that we really cling to, all the things that really matter to us. And so that's a very useful idea. There is no wealth but life. So concentrate on your portfolio of life and not on your portfolio of cash.
How do we implement this, though? Does this have to be a trickle-down? Do we need a ministry for fun or happiness?
I think we need to look once again at all the philosophies of consolation and fulfillment that have always existed alongside the dominant capitalist model of wealth creation and happiness. And these have tended to emphasize such things as compassion, wisdom, the community over the individual, all of these values that seem almost do-goodish, but that are awaiting really to be recast in a new and exciting language, because actually a term like compassion doesn't have to be the rather dusty, cobwebbed notion that we think it is. You see it articulated in Japanese Zen philosophy in extremely attractive ways. So we're looking for artists and philosophers to recast these things, and for a new generation that's also been used to materialism, because I think that, you know, we've grown more prosperous, we've grown used to luxury, and we don't necessarily have to do away with it. We simply have to become properly materialistic, by which I mean really enjoy our goods.
Fiona, I want to jump to Tokyo, and it's interesting, Anna, how you reference Japan, because what is it with young entrepreneurs and the fact that you've got people who are running restaurants, who are running shops, who are 27, 32, who seem very content with their jobs, with their, I don't know, whether they're taking home $30,000 or $40,000 a year, but they're not looking to IPO their business. What is it about the Japanese makeup that allows this to happen?
Well, I think, you know, Japan's been through a very hard time economically. And, you know, recently, exactly the issues that Alan is talking about, they've come up in Japan. People are looking to scale back. I mean, that may change now that the yen has risen so much. They'll be back shopping in Europe. But I think for a lot of people, they realise that maybe the big companies that used to be their security, it just wasn't working anymore, and people were losing their job, and they started to see other opportunities. So you do get a lot of young people opening small furniture workshops, cafes, and they're not making a lot of money, actually, even though they're getting a lot of coverage in the newspapers. But you see a lot of that in Tokyo.
But they all seem quite genki. I mean, that is the amazing thing, though, that, and I'm not sure if it's been sort of this lost decade, but it does make you look at the landscape here, Alain, slightly, that, you know, how long is it going to take us to get to that point where people actually seem very happy in their job that they started themselves and can also impart that on other people?
I mean, there's always an opportunity cost to starting your own business. And in a recession, you're not losing out on any golden opportunities if you cut yourself adrift from the rat race and actually start that furniture workshop. So a craft life, by which I mean not just necessarily making furniture, but generally approaching life and career from a kind of craft-based perspective, is really, I think, going to be the big theme for many people of the next working year.
Andrew, we've been talking about craft for almost 2 years now since we launched, and this is not a backpatting session. But if you look at the European landscape, if you look across the Atlantic to North America, what do you think it's going to take to actually kickstart this and to, I think, perhaps you bring about some type of mindset change that not everyone is looking to bring their business to the NASDAQ?
I think what is fascinating is the number of companies that we've come across recently where you realise that their success or their appeal is about value, but it's not about value in cash terms. It's about making something valuable that people can rely upon and trust. And I was very struck by a company called Stumptown that's in the current issue, which is a coffee company out of Portland. But it's so unlike the big change. You know, the guy who's founded it, Dwayne Sorensen, he's invested in bringing over the people who grow the beans in Africa to America on internships and paying them American wage. The people who buy the coffee, he tells them about the coffee. He hasn't tried to grow his business big. He's tried to grow his business slow. And he seems to be, you know, a really fine example of the things that we've been talking about for many years about, you know, make something with your hands, think about every single aspect of your business, deliver something that people really, really want and value. And I think that people like that will be the role models going forward, not the big companies, not the owners of the chains.
Rob, do you see that also? I mean, you referenced it at the top of the show, if we look at sort of the musical and also film landscape as well.
I think so. And I also think people will spend more time considering the things they spend their money on, whether it's records or a visit to the cinema. And probably, I think, book clubs have been popular over the last 5 years, but I think there'll be a greater proliferation of those next year as well, possibly. People trying to get more out of what they're listening to and watching and reading, I think, as well.
But Alain, you said that some people are going to, or at least probably most people will end 2009 a little poorer than they started. But you've got a book coming out. So what does that say for you? And then tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the book is called The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And it is really just that. It's looking at the working landscape. The underlying theme is, what's the point of our work? For many of us, 2009 will be a time when we'll be taking a step back and asking ourselves, why are we doing this? The question of meaning, not just financial meaning, obviously, but broader sort of human meaning. And so that's really the theme of the book. But I looked at 10 different industries and always try to ask the big questions, but mixing it in with reportage. So it should be an interesting read. We're hoping, my publishers are hoping anyway, that people are going to stay at home and read, that that's going to be the theme of 2009. We're not going to be going out and spending too much money, which is going to be the modest pleasures of a good book.
Excellent. Alain de Botton, thank you very much for joining us. In a moment, culture editor Robert Bound will be back with his cultural picks to keep you cozy over the holidays. You're at the Monocle Weekly from London. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's now just me and our culture editor. Okay, now let's pretend we're snowbound in an alpine chalet, and we only have our DVD player and iPod CD player, whatever we have to play music on. What would be your pick? If you could actually bring just one thing up to the mountains with you, what would it be?
Well, I've been keeping an eye on a Glaswegian band called the Phantom Band, and it's good winter music as well.
What does that mean?
Well, it's got a really crunchy, organic sound. It sounds like it could have been recorded on a four-track recorder in the 1960s, but in a good way. It's sort of quite classic rock, but it's very imaginative stuff. The LP is called Checkmate Savage, and it's loosely based around sort of the fall of mankind.
sounds cheery.
But it's lighter than it sounds, I promise you.
Okay, we'll have a listen.
I'm standing on the edge. I'm standing on the edge. I'm looking over, swaying from side to side. I'm jumping up and down.
That was the Phantom Band. What else do you have?
A compilation from Vampire Weekend, who produced one of the records of 2008. They've made a compilation for Rough Trade Records, who they're released on in the UK. And it's all their influences, which includes sort of hip-hop, a lot of sort of African music. It's a really rich listen, and it's a sort of great party record. Make a great addition to the fireside in your alpine chalet as well.
Here it is. That was John Mayer on Vampire Weekend's compilation. Moving over to the video side, if you could pop one thing in the DVD player next Friday night, next Saturday, what would it be?
Well, I still push people towards Gary Hustwit's latest film, which is out on DVD, called Helvetica, which unbelievably was a fascinating and hilarious and engaging movie about a typeface, about the 50-year anniversary of a typeface. And it had design and type luminaries getting into a real lather of passion and hatred for this clean, beautiful way of communicating the typefaces that have been the face of American Airlines and American Apparel for years. And he has a new film, in fact, in the new year, which I'm very much looking forward to, which is called Objectified, which is about people's relationship with things, with the way things are designed. But for the DVD player this winter, Helvetica is still a great find.
And if you look out over the months ahead in film, what are you looking forward to?
I think there's perhaps a trend for Europeans, particularly Brits and Germans, making films that are going to do well in Hollywood or going to be doing well in American cinemas. State of Play and In the Loop are two British, in fact, BBC series, one comedy, one drama series, one political drama series, that are being remade by their respective British producers for big budget American productions. And I think, despite the trend of these things, they look really good and really slick and either very politically thrilling or very funny, which is rare, it seems.
Great. Rob, thank you very much. In a moment, Fiona Wilson is back with a look at the retail landscape for 2009. This is the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London. And I'm now with Fiona Wilson, our Asia editor and Tokyo bureau chief. I want to talk a little bit about retail and everything in the run-up to the holidays. You know, and I think almost every day we were hearing the overnight performance of various brands. You've been based in Tokyo for some time now. Is there that same level of attention when you look in the Nikkei every day? Are they talking about how Uniqlo did over the past weekend? Are they talking about the performance of a big department store like Isetan? Is there that same focus on the high street that we have in the UK and elsewhere in Europe?
I mean, those are both very good examples, actually, because they've both been in the papers a lot, because Uniqlo has bucked the trend this year. It's doing incredibly well. Profits are up. They're looking at ¥1 trillion sales a year by 2010. And department stores have had a very difficult time. So Isetan merging with Mitsukoshi is the big story of the department stores. So we don't know how that's going to work out yet. And there's talk about squabbling, and we'll see who comes out on top there.
We talked about the lost decade earlier, and it is amazing. And I wonder if a lot, you know, if many more analysts and a lot of other journalists are going to be looking to Japan to see how they got through this. I guess in part, this is a nation which has always saved. There were savings. We talked about savings under the mattress. Is that part of the reason why Louis Vuitton, you know, it still remained Louis Vuitton's biggest market?
I think that was baffling for people who came to visit Japan during the recession. I mean, you saw the world's biggest Louis Vuitton opening, huge Prada store, you know, bigger than any other city in the world. And at the same time, we were being told in the financial press that Japan was very depressed. I mean, I think it's partly priorities. People chose to spend what money they had on a few very good quality products. And it's a lot to do with the way people live. Young women still living at home with their parents, they had spare cash, and what they chose to spend it on was a luxury handbag.
And it was interesting to watch how a number of Japanese brands entered the world stage from a retail perspective, certainly Muji. And of course, there's a value proposition there. Also, Uniqlo at the same time. The likes of 7-Eleven became more aggressive internationally. Do you think there's any lessons that European, North American retailers elsewhere can learn from Japan?
Definitely. I mean, from top to bottom, you know, from service to presentation, politeness of staff, wrapping. You know, if you go shopping in Japan, even to a convenience store, you get really excellent service. And I think one of the interesting things that came out of this year, I mean, one of my favourite surveys of the year is the Nikkei's roundup of hit products. And this year, all the favourite products were low cost but high value products like Uniqlo. They're shifting millions of pairs of their skinny jeans. And I think a lot of people are looking at them because the products themselves are cheap, but the experience of shopping is really excellent. And that isn't really replicated anywhere else in the world at the moment.
Is it exportable, though, or do you have to export the Japanese staff as well to make it happen? Because certainly when you spend time, you know, in any of the best stores, you know, anywhere in Japan, you feel that you'd have to spend a lot of time almost brainwashing staff in Stockholm, in Los Angeles, to achieve that same level of service.
I think you definitely have to, at least initially, export some management to train people up. It's such a different way of selling products. And I think most Japanese people are quite surprised when they come out of Japan at the level of service, how poor it is. So I think, you know, definitely, if you want to see Uniqlo in Japan, and then you come to London, you want to see have the same experience. And I think they've done that pretty well, actually.
Andrew, Uniqlo is a great example because all eyes till now have really been on Spain with Zara and Mango to an extent, and of course on Sweden with H&M. Do you think Uniqlo have a shot at it? Because Muji stumbled a bit in Europe and they're just trying to find their way in North America. But it seems that, as Fiona was referencing, over the last year, they really started to up their game in Europe.
Yeah, I think they definitely have a chance here. And you see that already with their stores. They look innovative. They look fresh. There's something about them that kind of already draws people in. And just picking up on what Fiona's saying, I think what's fascinating is that there's been such a stranglehold on our high streets by a few landlords who have said again and again to people who want to come onto the high street, you can only come in if you've got 20 shops, 30 shops, a proven track record. What I think is actually great about the year ahead is it's going to crack that monopoly. People are going to have to go out and find new retailers to come onto the high street. And especially in kind of Europe where you see the same stores on every single street, I think that's what's going to come to an end. Suddenly you'll find the person starting off their business can actually afford a shop on a high street, whereas up to now people have just been absolutely priced out of the market. So I think that although there's lots of kind of, you know, worries in the year ahead, I do think for retail in the UK and Europe and America, it's actually going to be a great, great time to start a business.
Peter, if I'm not mistaken, people still buy CDs in Japan, correct?
They do, absolutely. I mean, the sort of dominance of iTunes that's happened everywhere else hasn't really happened in Japan.
Rob, do you think that that actually presents an opportunity? Because a lot of people talk about the death of the likes of HMV and all of the big chains. Do you think it's game over for them? And is there room then for the small, cozy retailer who knows his way around a CD stack?
Well, I think that's the thing. It's the service thing. I think there's going to be not a lot between iTunes and downloads and fantastic independent record stores. I think Zavvi has been a case in point of how not to start a new brand. I mean, it's the new Virgin in the UK, and it's how not to do a record store. It's ugly, and it literally looks like the last 3 days of Woolworths, but from day one.
Right, well, on that optimistic note, we're going to leave it there. Well, that's all for this first edition of the Monocle Weekly. This programme goes live every Sunday at 12 o'clock Central European Time, and of course you can get more information about upcoming editions at monocle.com. This programme was produced by Gillian Tobias and researched by Alyssa Kirby and Alex Mills, and the sound engineer was Chris Sharp. But for now, for all of us here in London, New York and Tokyo, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Fiona Wilson.
And I'm Robert Vound.
Have a happy New Year.